Well, we've talked a lot about the UFOs, the Navy aircraft chasing them, and David Serrata, of course, our special guest, has done his own analysis of this story. It is amazing. And if you have some time, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website and look at some of the graphics that David has supplied us already. It'll help you go along with the story here. But we'll be back with David Serrata, calls with him next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Let me tell you a little bit about David Serrata. First aspiration in life was to become an astronaut, as a lot of us did in that era. In 1968, David and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After this experience, he grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt about the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident back in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, science led him on his career in related fields, and he has worked deeply in high technology, environmental, humanitarian issues, and as a professional photographer for more than 20-plus years now. He has studied world religion, science, physics, paranormal psychology, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, David, how have you been?
Oh, my God, it's good to hear your voice, George. It's been too long.
You too. Miss you, my friend. I hope you're well and the family's good. Everybody's okay?
Everybody's okay. Nobody has coronavirus here.
Well, that's good. I'm still not sure it's as, well, you know, for those who died, it's horrible, and the families that are afflicted, but I think it's starting to go down, isn't it? Isn't it starting to go away?
Well, we have virtually almost no cases here where I am, but it seems to be dying off. And ultimately, it's not worse than the flu was in 2018, where over 100,000 Americans died. And my mom died that year, actually, of pneumonia. So, pneumonia kills 3 million people a year worldwide. So I think they've blown this thing way out of proportion myself.
Yeah, and what a situation we're in right now, David, with these demonstrations and looting and all that stuff. But tonight was the most peaceful night so far of the last 7-8 days. So let's hope that goes
on,
too.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with what they're doing. You know, the police kneeling down and, you know, trying to come from the heart and pray. I mean, that was a miracle this morning when I saw that on the news.
Yeah, see, the biggest issue right now is those people who are looting, burning, and things like that, these are thugs. These are domestic terrorists. These aren't the protesters who have an issue here. These are people who are out to undermine the United States. And we're dealing with these different factions, and people are, you know, and they're mixed in with the protesters who are just trying to get their message out. And
I feel for George Floyd. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco in the 60s, and a lot of my best friends were, you know, of different color. And to me, they're not African Americans. They're Americans. There's over 50 million, you know, people of this ethnicity in America. So you can't call them a minority, and calling them a minority is injustice. They're Americans. They're people. And there are so many of us of different colors. And white people are not all one white lump, you know, of people. I mean, there's Nordics and there's Russians and Jews and Greeks and Italians, and they all get called to be whites. But we all got to learn that we're all God's creation, and we're all beautiful. You know, all of us are beautiful. So why do people feel that one race is, you know, a problem or needs to be exterminated? I don't get it. I don't get it myself. I just see everybody as beautiful. So,
absolutely. Well, let's begin, my friend.
George, I've got information on this Navy UFO case. It's staggering. I mean, I'm sitting here so blown away right now at the data that I have. And to me, this is the single most important UFO case of the day, of the current time. And that's because it's U.S. military, it's U.S. Navy, it's verified fact UFOs. And the press and the media has done a job on this, and they're trying to use speed and velocity of the craft as a way of controlling the story. And they're trying to, like, see, here's one thing that nobody did in the story so far that I did, and I've been calling for this amongst other ufologists on Facebook, but, you know, nobody's listening. You need a speed chart. And a velocity chart shows, like, what is the speed of our current, arsenal of aircraft? And The aircraft that David Fravor was flying in November 14, 2004, the Nimitz incident, couldn't go faster than 1,600 miles an hour. And I'm going to give you a really good picture of the velocity here so you can see how even the current New York Times articles are leaning towards drones, which is the most absurd thing you could ever hear. Because drones, most of them are less than Mach 1, so less than 760 miles an hour. Some of them are half of that. There's a few stable drones at Mach 2, which is, you know, almost 1,600 miles an hour, you know, as fast as the fighter that David Fravor was flying and, you know, chasing these things. And we have radar. And one of the things about the radar, a lot of people don't know this, is the radar can see 200 miles. That's over a million feet. So in this People magazine article, and magazines like People magazine, they do their fact checking. And these UFOs were seen on radar above 80,000 feet, dropping to sea level in 0.78 seconds. And dropping from above 80,000 feet to sea level in 0.78 seconds is over 67,000 miles per hour.
Jeez.
So 80,000 feet divided by 5,280 feet per mile times 60 times 60. 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour. That's 67,000 miles an hour. So this is how the press, nobody has put the calculation of the velocity in the story. And what they keep doing is dropping that velocity to, you know, 20,000 miles an hour on these UFOs. So we have drones. I mean, DARPA made the HTV-2, which was tested at Mach 22, and that's 16,874 miles per hour. So it's a tad slower than the velocities being stated. But if you do the math, you'll see it's not the pilots who are trying to control the velocity, it's the press. And the press, including the New York Times, is guilty of this because either they don't know how to do simple math, or they want these things to appear slower so they can fit within the range of our fastest flying, you know, missiles. Like,
well, those are our ICBMs, right?
Right. So your ICBM, your Minuteman is the fastest thing alive. It reaches just under 18,000 miles an hour. So we're still a tad slower than the UFO. But here's the problem: the faster you go as a missile, you can't turn. And so an ICBM will go above the atmosphere, and then it drops back down on its target straight down. So it comes straight down. It does this big, long arch and drops down on its target. But you can't do a sudden stop and a sudden turn. So remember, these UFOs that Fravor was following on the FLIR footage, which just got released, is the Nimitz incident. It is footage from a number of the UFOs that David Fravor was chasing. It's not necessarily the one he was chasing, but you can see on the COAST site, I did a frame-by-frame analysis, and I put it into, you know, Final Cut Pro and went one frame at a time. And you're shooting 30 frames a second, which is standard video. And you can see structure on this thing. This thing has, it kind of looks like wedding bands, like three wedding bands, almost like remember the movie Contact, the big machine that was made?
Yep, and it kind of revolved, right?
Right. It's kind of like that. It's a little staticky, the image. So I did some color mapping, and you can see a vortex spiral and that in the structure. Now, that's not stagnant, meaning it's not moving. That spiral isn't moving. That seems to be solid structure in the FLIR image. And I'm going one frame at a time, and you can see the third image at the top on the right. It just kind of turns into pure wavelets. When I zoom in on an image, I see waves. And then this is the most miraculous thing it does. These things are locked in the crosshairs. We have a stable camera. There's no jittering around of the cameras. We see the UFO split in two twice. And It only does this in a single frame, which means a 30th of a second, super fast. All of a sudden, there's two UFOs, and then all of a sudden, there's one UFO again, the next frame. And what that means to me, this is incredibly sophisticated technology. This is something, I mean, I took physics in school, and I worked for Nobel Prize-winning physicists, and I worked for Boak and Magwitch.
You know your business. There's no doubt about
that. I know my business, and I can tell you that the first thing this conjures up in my mind is not split video frames, because we don't have those anymore. But what this is, remember the double slit experiment, the famous quantum experiment, where you put two slits in a piece of cardboard, and the same electron goes through both slits at the same time. Not two different electrons, the same electron. And an electron has mass, and therefore it's physical. And a particle of light will do the same thing. It will go through both slits at the same time. And that's what this image beckons me with. This thing is it's almost like it's, if you understand on a molecular level what material matter is made of, it's all dipoles. Everything is positive and negative, little magnets, little atoms building molecules into geometries that make up the periodic table of elements. It's almost like this thing is splitting into two monopoles. And monopoles can theoretically go incredibly fast. The speed of light or possibly greater, and that's proven in the field of physics. So is this thing dividing into two monopoles and then getting ready to just bolt off? Well, it does this twice, so that rules out chance of an anomaly. So you can see I've got two images of it splitting in two. And nobody else has noticed this. Louis Elizondo's team has not noticed this because they didn't do a frame-by-frame analysis. And, you know, this is only one of three of the original pieces of video that were released. They released Gimbal, Go Fast, and FLIR. So Gimbal is from the East Coast, and we have Lieutenant Ryan Graves' testimony on what he saw with his eyes and the structure of that one. But right now, let's just focus on FLIR, because when we go to the testimony of Sean Cahill, who was on the Nimitz. He was an officer on the Nimitz, and I've been in touch with him by email. He's written me, and I've sent him stuff that is utterly mind-blowing. Sean saw on the Nimitz, you'll see this in the series Unidentified with Louis Elizondo on History Channel, right? He sees them go like counterclockwise, all these luminous craft, and one by one they disappear through a vortex. Now, remember, you're looking at an image that has a structural vortex in it. You can see it, and it's there. It's in the data, in the imagery. Now, when the Navy radar operator, Kevin Day, told Elizondo that they know where they disappeared off radar at a north latitude of 28.91 degrees, so that's 10 base. You know, instead of degrees, minutes, and seconds, 10 base, and 118.26 west, which is Guadalupe Island off the coast of Baja, Mexico. Now, here's what interests me. First of all, I thought, why don't they understand that that's a stargate? And second of all, when Elizondo took Sean Cahill to the island on boats, I mean, this is an amazing trip. They discover that there's a magnetic geophysical anomaly north of the north end of the island. And guess what the latitude there is? The same as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. 29 degrees, 58 minutes, 45 seconds is right north of this island.
No coincidences, believe, David. No coincidences.
See, we're getting somewhere. See, what this means, George, and there's one more link here. Guess where the Houston Control Center is in Houston? Same
latitude.
Same north latitude.
Jeez.
So now remember, a latitude degree is a 69-mile-wide band. And while that seems wide, if you fly up in space where the space shuttle is, you can draw a line with a pencil, and it can be 69 miles wide. So that width of that band going all the way around the planet connects the Great Pyramids of Egypt, It connects the disappearing point of the, I'm relying on the magnetic anomaly in the sea north of the island as a true disappearing point, whereas their data, they got a radar ping from the center of Guadalupe Island, and I think that's a mistake. It's the magnetic anomaly, which is just a little bit further north.
Well, what are you concluding, David?
Well, I'm concluding that we have, this is data. This is real data. This is the most powerful UFO case in current history at the present time. We're not talking about Roswell. I'm not talking about, you know, the other cases that are very famous. I'm talking about right now. And I'm concluding that NASA made the Houston Control Center there on purpose, because what happens with a sphere is that basically the frequency of the Earth changes depending on the wavelength, which is the circumference of the Earth at that latitude. And therefore, the pyramids were built on that latitude, probably because there was a natural band that we can't see with the naked eye. But that band is an entry-exit point. And that's what Sean Cahill
saw. It's a stargate, right?
It's a stargate. Exactly. And the stargate, the pyramids were used to activate the stargate, and the stargate lines up with the Houston Control Center. I mean, we're talking about a, you know, the Houston Control Center is 29 degrees, 33 minutes. Where the UFOs disappeared is 29 degrees, 58 minutes. The Great Pyramid is 29 degrees, 58 minutes, and the Sphinx and all of it. It's all right there, right? So a single minute is just a little over a mile, just to give people an example. So you're talking about this band that goes all the way around the planet that joins all three of these. And this cannot be coincidence. It can't, because you have three connecting points. So what did the Houston Control Center, we know that was built a long time ago. Did NASA build it there because they knew exactly what I'm telling everybody tonight? They knew this. And therefore, they knew there was a connection to a frequency band around the Earth that Tesla and Schumann mapped in the days of their research. In fact, Tesla filed in the year, I think it was the year 1900, I can't remember, where he filed for a patent for a form of radio waves that travels two times the speed of light. So we don't know what happened to Tesla's technology, but I can tell you this, we know very little about telecommunication systems. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because here's the biggest weakness in the story. Biggest weaknesses in the story is nobody has intercepted a communication from the ET. So,
oh, wouldn't that be something? My gosh, you think SETI would pick it up? I guess not.
Well, no, SETI wouldn't pick this up because they're right here. They come through the Stargate.
And they're aimed, SETI's aimed out into space, right?
SETI's aimed out into space. So you just have to know the frequency. I can calculate myself easily, because it's just the speed of light in feet divided by the circumference of the Earth at that north latitude in feet, and I got the frequency. And wow, that means something magical is happening at that
point. We're going to take a break, David. When we come back, I want you to explain, if you can for us, exactly what you think the Navy pilots saw, how that thing came about. And I guess you're concluding that these objects came in and out of portals, which is fascinating all by itself. David Cereda, our special guest. We'll take calls with David next hour. Get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and look at the graphics that David sent us. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, David Cereda with us. And again, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website and look at the graphics that David has supplied here based on his analysis. David, for a lot of people who may not be familiar with the Navy fighter jet sightings, kind of give us a little highlight of these.
Well, actually, in November 14th, 2004, you know, the case of David Fravor and what was known as the USS Nimitz case, it was originally published in Fighter Suite magazine. In the Fighter Suite magazine article, Tom DeLong and his crew got a hold of that story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they built everything around that. But then there's another case called Gimbel and Lieutenant Ryan Graves. That's the East Coast, the East Upper Atlantic. And they were in the presence of over 100 of these UFOs.
Jeez.
And in those, and that was about 2015, the year 2015. And those were cubes and spheres all in one. So Graves said it was a ball, spherical metallic kind of ball. It would have to be translucent because he saw the points of the cube protruding just beyond the edges of the sphere. And he estimated the sizes based on his radar analysis to be in the 40 to 46 foot range in diameter. And that means, okay, first of all, cube is not aerodynamic, but they're outperforming them, that we have the same type of velocities that could be in the range of 20,000 miles an hour and all the way up to 67,000 miles an hour, as I've earlier stated. Now, our aircraft can barely do 1,600 miles an hour. I'm talking about fighters. There's still nothing faster than the Lockheed SR-71, which is around 2,600 miles per hour. I'm just going off the top of my head from looking at the data recently. But you see, the problem is you can't turn. The faster you're going, a turn, and I have a lot of experience in this. I mean, I was a skydiver. I trained at Edwards Air Force Base with the military as a civilian, to jump from 30,000 feet in Davis, California. And I can tell you that even, like, we went in these hyperbaric chambers at Edwards Air Force Base, and they test you as a pilot to jump from 30,000 feet. And most people, doesn't matter how muscular you are, how fit you are, which I was in those days, some people are going to black out with just a few G's, and some people are going to handle a lot of G's. And some people are going to black out from hypoxia, from oxygen starvation to the brain, and see spots in front of your eyes. Like, they had us do all these math questions and draw a circle, and meanwhile, they're starving you of oxygen. And I saw guys across from me just nod off and pass out. And I was still awake, and then I started seeing spots. And then there's this other guy who's just doing freaking fine, right? So what I'm saying is, when you're a pilot, you have the right stuff. You've got 20/20 vision. You know every enemy airplane, every enemy missile, every allied missile by name, make, model, and number. You know the velocities of these missiles that we have. And you know what you're looking at isn't anything. It's not a drone. And when the press, like this recent article in the New York Times where Wesley Keene was co-authoring, they're trying to tell us this thing was 5 feet, the size of a suitcase, and it's a drone. Like, I mean, give me a break. This is where the press is really absurd. You're not talking to pilots. You're not talking about their data that says 46 feet. This is in the Gimbel case, you know.
Well, how did they get from these 40 to 50-foot UFOs down to 5 feet?
Exactly. And that's what they're doing is they reduce the velocities because they want the velocities to be in the range of drones. But even though DARPA made the HDV-2 and it did Mach 22, 16,874 miles per hour, they only made two of them. So they're not in service at all because they don't perform. You can't turn. You can't turn. And so these UFOs are turning, stopping on a dime, suddenly accelerating. So because a human physiologically is 87% water, what do you think is going to happen if I drop you at 67,000 miles an hour and stop on a dime above the sea? You will liquefy in the cockpit. And the structure, the metallic structure of the way we make aircraft, we don't make aircraft out of carbon. We don't make it. We make aircraft. They would crumble like a cookie because they're just cheap frames with very thin skin lining. The way we make these things, it would crumble like a cookie, and the pilot would be crushed. Like when you go high altitude, for example, our skin is held together by atmospheric pressure. So when I was skydiving from 30,000 feet, there's enough pressure up there to hold my skin on me, but not very much. And when I jump out of the plane, I'm doing 300 miles an hour plus, and I hit the lower atmosphere. It's like jumping into a lake. If you hit sudden turbulence that is so violent, it's the same as jumping into water. Like, I've jumped off cliffs that are 115 feet into a lake, and it feels the same.
Can we rule out, David, though, that these are definitely not ours, Russian or Chinese?
See, absolutely. Because, first of all, one, you've got this, you know, the UFO is splitting in two, and therefore it's going into this quantum state, which is probably dividing its poles. So it's got two monopoles, a negative and a positive monopole. The UFO's atomic structure is dividing. It's going through a stargate. The stargate is in perfect alignment to the Great Pyramids of Egypt. So I would only deduct that the god who built the Great Pyramid is responsible for the stargates that let these things in and out. Now, cubes and spheres, that's the Holy of Holies. So the Holy of Holies is a cube in Solomon's temple that's 20 by 20 by 20 cubits. And if you go back to the time of Moses, God had Moses build a tabernacle to surround the Ark of the Covenant that was 10 by 10 by 10 cubits. And that, using the most accurate royal cubit to inches, 20.605 inches, is 17.17 feet. And guess what that is? That's the Queen's Chamber. It's a perfect duplicate of Moses's Holy of Holies tabernacle to surround the Ark of the Covenant. And the King's Chamber is 10 by 20 cubits. Well, that's a perfect. It's called the Holy Place that extends beyond the tabernacle. So that means, you know, I wrote a book called God's Great Pyramid, and I followed up on the work of the French mathematician Peter Lemazurier, who wrote the Great Pyramid Decoded, published in the mid-70s. And we both concluded, and I concluded this mathematically, that the pyramid is built with the same math for every dimension that the God of the prophets gave the prophets to build everything. Everything has the same numbers. When you use the 20.605 inch cubit, Noah's Ark is 515125 feet. The Ark of the Covenant is 51.5125 inches. The table before the Lord is 5.15125 feet. You keep seeing the same numbers, the same numbers, the same numbers. And that means that, okay, first of all, the Holy of Holies is a cube with a sphere of light known as Shekinah that resides inside. Ryan Graves, Lieutenant Ryan Graves on the East Coast Atlantic on the Gimbo incident.
He's the one who saw about 100 of these things, right?
Yeah, but they were cubes and spheres, and they're within the range size that I'm looking for a Holy of Holies.
Which is the pilot that saw these submerged objects?
Okay, so you're going back to the Nimitz, and you're going back to the case of where the UFOs disappeared through the Stargate that connects to Houston and the Great Pyramid. Now, those UFOs, Fravor is looking over his shoulder, and he sees this, and he sees it go under the ocean. They get double confirmation from Navy sonar. Radar can't travel. Microwave can't travel through salt water. So they use sonar, which is a very dense sound wave. And these
things
were
what we have on all our subs.
They were doubling the speed of the fastest subs we have. So we know they're going underwater. We know that it's very likely, if you draw the connection that Robert Temple made in the Sirius mystery, the Syrians, which connect to ancient Egypt, were aquatic beings, mermaid, merman-type beings.
And you're not talking Syrians from Syria, either.
No, you're talking about Sirius, the star Sirius A and B, I could tell you stories, because I've actually had meetings with them. But nevertheless, those, you're drawing a connection from that star as aquatic beings who need to live underwater. So if you draw that connection to the pyramids, and then you draw the pyramids to the Stargate to where the UFO that disappeared, you know, that the Nimitz crew. And the Nimitz crew was seeing these UFOs for over 2 weeks. This wasn't a one-day incident. And incidentally...
Yeah, these were ongoing, weren't they?
There I was in Los Angeles analyzing UFO footage from this young guy in Venice, California, and going frame by frame, and it's the identical time period of the Nimitz. It's 2014. It's I've got these pictures. I can see the windows on the craft. I can see them really good. They're all on my computer right now. I just can't publish them because of the guy who owns them. But they line up off the coast of, you know, right off the coast of Venice Beach at the same time period as the Nimitz. And they look like Tic Tacs, but I can see the windows. I can see the portal. Now, if you look at the link that you have on the Coast site to the Fighter Sweep article, which is where this story really broke, it's not Leslie Keen who broke the story. It's this other pilot who wrote the article in Fighter Sweep about Dave Fravor and what he encountered.
Yeah, I mean, David must have told these people, these pilots, and they ran with it.
And that's what they ran with it, and then eventually the New York Times got it, then Rolling Stone, then CNN, ABC. Everybody's running.
And DeLong's group picked it up.
There is so much data in this story that, first of all, the Cuban sphere is, to me, is the Holy of Holies, and then which connects to the Great Pyramids of Egypt and Solomon's Temple, and the Tabernacle of Moses. So you can draw a connection there, and you could say that's creative and abstract, but if you do the math the way I do it, I'm looking for measurements. I'm looking for measurements because measurements are the code. But now let's go to, you go to the gimbal incident in the Atlantic with Lieutenant Ryan Graves, who has visual confirmation of what he's seeing. I don't know why Ryan Graves didn't get together with a sketch artist and do a perfect drawing, you know, artist rendering of what he saw, because that would help.
That would have helped a lot, and that would have been the perfect thing.
That would have been the perfect thing. But here's what interests me about Gimbal. I've analyzed that footage frame by frame, and he saw a cube and a sphere. But what I'm seeing on the camera is a rectangle, either a square, probably a square or a rectangle. When you look at Gimbal's footage, you think, oh, that's lenticular, that's a flying saucer. No, take it into Photoshop, adjust the light, get rid of the brightness. You're looking at a rectangle. Now, if you go all the way back to Major Bob White test flying the X, Major Bob White broke the sound barrier. He was one of the first test pilots on the you know, breaking the sound barrier rockets, just like, you know, Chuck Yeager, you know, flying glamorous planes. And so there's Major Bob White in Time magazine looking out his window. This is Edwards Air Force Base. I skydived out there for years. I know that's where I did my house skydiving. I know that base. I've been on that base. I've been on a lot of bases, actually, because of the work that I used to do and in the military. And he saw out the window, this is in Time magazine, a rectangle. Not a cube, a rectangle. Now, that doesn't mean that Lieutenant Ryan Graves didn't see a cube in a sphere. It means the camera could only see structurally the square or rectangle. And therefore, the cube in the sphere would be something much more translucent.
But you're concluding these are extraterrestrial craft coming from some stargate, not some planetary system,
right. They're,
but
they're
a stargate.
They're coming through a stargate, possibly from Sirius, because they're interested in our oceans. Now, you know, you've interviewed Preston Dennett in his amazing book about UFOs off the coast of California. Well, let's go back to, I don't know why Luis Elizondo didn't do this. The Battle of 42 were these huge, bulbous, glowing UFOs right off of Redondo Beach.
That's when they were shooting at it from here, from Los Angeles.
They shot over 1,400 rounds, told everybody to stay in their houses all night. And then the George C. Marshall memorandums gave evidence that we did shoot down one of those craft and retrieved it in the mountains between Edwards Air Force Base and the coast, and the craft was taken there.
And some people reported hearing pinging every time the artillery shells were fired.
Oh, I didn't know that, George. So that means they hit something.
They hit something up there, and they weren't balloons.
Therefore, you've got a history of UFOs off the coast of Baja in California that goes way back. That means they're established. They're established. And they've been able to elude us all this time.
That's a great story. I mean, and what spurred your interest on this one, David?
Well, what's spurred my interest in it is, you know, I'm a filmmaker. I was a professional photographer for over 20 years. There was good footage. And remember when I released the NASA UFO tapes, the tapes from my friend Martin Stubbs in Vancouver, Canada, who recorded all these NASA images?
Right.
And those cameras could see invisible, both infrared and ultraviolet light. I was very interested in the invisible because I had that ability myself. I could see things that other people couldn't see. And so I was interested in how and why that was happening to me. So when I looked at the phenomena of photography and cameras being able to see things that humans couldn't see that were UFOs, and then I saw this case, and I saw, well, there's FLIR cameras, and FLIR cameras have a certain sensitivity to, you know, visible and invisible light. And when you're looking at craft, again, that have no thrust, no heat signature, the altitude, I mean, this is one thing I learned when I skydived from 30,000 feet. It was minus 75 outside degrees when I jumped. And it's not minus 75 for very long, but at that temperature, you get a really clean background on an infrared camera because it's cold. So that's your background. This is November, remember. November.
Exactly. Hold on, David. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about your incredible work and then this incredible story, to be sure. And then we'll take some phone calls, too, next hour. David Cereda, our special guest. His website is all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We make it very easy for you to track what the guest is doing. So we'll be back with your calls and more with David in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.